Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show. Happy to be with you on this Thursday, June 9th. Hope you're wide awake and ready to take on the day, as Dr. Laura used to say. Anyway, lots to talk about today. At the bottom of the hour, we're going to be talking to Dr. Stephen Bullivant from across the pond. Stephen Bullivant is senior lecturer in theology and ethics at St. Mary's University in London. Jolly old England. Anyway, he's written a piece that was actually in America magazine about the theology of Taylor Swift. T-Swizzle. You never knew it. Anyway, he's going to be on to talk about that. Should be fun. I am a closet Taylor Swift fan. Well, not so much closet, I think. So look forward to that conversation. And then in the second hour, Father Alan Carter, he's back. After several weeks, he had a couple of weeks there where he had priest convocation, then seminarian convocation, and then last week, of course, I was out of the studio enjoying the beautiful state park here in Kentucky. So it's going to be good to have him back, and we're going to be talking about, what are we going to be talking about? He texted me about this yesterday. He always gives me several options, and then I let him pick, oh yeah, the Year of Mercy in Ordinary Time. We are in this season of ordinary time now that we've gotten through the Easter season, culminating in Pentecost, and then we had Trinity Sunday and Corpus Christi Sunday. Now we've settled into ordinary time, which does not mean ordinary in the way we usually think of it as plain and unspecial, for example. It simply means it's this what is the normal life of being a Christian disciple. And anyway, we're going to talk about that in terms of the Year of Mercy. That's right. It's still the Year of Mercy, in case you have forgotten. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the time Muhammad Ali went and saw Billy Graham. Interesting piece I read about that. And we'll get into other things that we can find today as well. We'll look at the Cavs' big win last night, bouncing back in Game 3. We'll spin the Dollar Catechism wheel, and we'll make our What Were You Thinking nominees. And we'll also get into the Scriptures a little bit today. In fact, our question of the day is a scriptural one. So all that and more. No more shallow pop culture questions, which means, of course, I won't get any response. 573, prove me wrong, folks. 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to call or be a part of the program anytime today, or email me mikeallenshow@gmail.com. I had to limit my breakfast this morning to just some watermelon, because this sounds really crazy, I know, but for some reason, my wife has been into buying Pop-Tarts lately, which is a dangerous thing, because if there are Pop-Tarts in the house, I will eat them, particularly if they are blueberry or strawberry or my personal favorite, brown sugar cinnamon. Well, for some reason, eating brown sugar cinnamon Pop-Tarts has given me some sort of a sore spot on the side of my tongue. That's right, a tongue injury, where I'll play and hurt this time of year. So I had to eschew the Pop-Tarts this morning, which was not easy, but probably better for my waistline, to be honest with you. It might be an interesting question of the day. Food-related injuries. Peanut butter, Cap'n Crunch can tear up the roof of your mouth, for example. Or too hot a soup. You know what I mean? It's first world problems, I know. 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. What are the privileges of working full-time for the diocese, the local diocese here in Lexington, as the director of family life and evangelization, is I get to occasionally enjoy having Mass there celebrated by our bishop, Bishop John. I try not to take it for granted, and I really don't as much maybe as I might ordinarily, because I teach a class around the noon hour during the school year, and so oftentimes the Masses that Bishop John celebrates during the week are celebrated during the noon hour when I'm not there, but had an opportunity yesterday to go to Mass for the entire staff. We were celebrating Father Bob, who works there for the diocese as well, his 60th anniversary of his ordination. Pretty remarkable, really. We talked recently about the whole idea of vows and how we make vows, and whether it's vows for marriage, whether it's vows for priesthood. You know, when Father Bob, as a 25-year-old, made those vows, the power of a promise is you don't know, of course, how the rest of your life is going to unfold, but you bind yourself without condition to that mission and to that state of life, just as a married couple does much the same thing. That's the power of a vow. You bind yourself without condition to a person, to a state of life that you don't know how it's going to unfold, but you are, by the very definition, you are all in. So it was great to celebrate that. But it's nice. You know, we talk about the daily mass readings on the program here and enjoy doing that. It's nice, though, to be in mass and to simply be able to hear the daily readings being proclaimed. And as I've said before, I understand the sentiment, and I do it myself sometimes. When we go to mass and there's a reading, we pick up the missalette or whatever book is in our pew rack that has the reading in it, and we like to follow along with our eyes while the lector reads the reading. And that's a good, you know, it's not a bad thing. We Catholics would do well to have our eyes in the scriptures more often, even to carry Bibles around, which is not just a Protestant thing, by the way. Can be a Catholic thing, too. But I will say that I think, by and large, the scriptures in the Mass are meant to be proclaimed and to be heard. And sometimes, if you're listening to the reading in Mass and you don't have your eyes in the book, maybe even closing your eyes, which I realize can be a dangerous proposition if you're like me. Close your eyes, you may not get them open again. That's what I discovered a week ago Saturday when I went to go see Captain America Civil War. And we've got this theater in town that has renovated itself, and now they have these reclining seats, like footrests and all. Boy, that's a lethal combination for me these days going to the movie, because I've become my father, usually out by the 15-minute mark. So set that aside. It's still a good thing during Mass, if you have somebody there maybe who can give you an elbow if they hear you start snoring, to close your eyes and hear the scripture reading. And I was hearing yesterday's reading, this whole account of Elijah on Mount Carmel, dealing with the prophets of Baal. We talked a little bit about it yesterday. There are those who want to attribute the rise of smack talk to Muhammad Ali, who, of course, whose public memorial will be tomorrow. They're not going back far enough. Elijah in the Old Testament, the king of smack talk, taking on the 450 prophets of Baal. You know, I have this vision of him. You ever see basketball players playing in another team's home arena, and they're winning, they're quieting the crowd, and they hold that one finger up over their lips, like, shh. I'm sure when you're an elite-level athlete, there's no greater pleasure than silencing the home crowd. For some reason, I get this image of Elijah. As he's challenging the 450 prophets of Baal, they've prepared the sacrifice, they've cut the bulls into pieces, they've placed it on the wood, and they begin to cry out in this sort of cosmic contest. The 450 prophets of Baal and Elijah calling out to their respective gods on who will come and consume the sacrifice. And this passage in 1 Kings, the biblical writer seems to really take delight in portraying the desperate cries of the prophets of Baal and how nothing happened. Even though they cut themselves, even though they pleaded, it says noon passed and they remained in a prophetic state until the time for offering sacrifice, but there was not a sound, no one answered, and no one was listening. But what struck me as I heard this unfold, you know, as I heard this proclaimed in the Mass and heard it anew, which I think is a great gift of the Spirit and the living nature of the Scriptures, so we can hear it a million times and hear something new each time. But it struck me, I don't know why I hadn't thought of it before. Wow, there was only one prophet left faithful to the God of Israel. One? And yet there were 450 prophets of Baal? We have such historical blinders on most of the time. Maybe you're a faithful Catholic and you sometimes get frustrated within the church, where you see perhaps, compromise, or you get frustrated with cafeteria Catholics in your estimation, people who pick and choose what they want to believe. And maybe you're frustrated because, there are things in your own parish that drive you crazy, that you're wishing that, maybe you had a stronger pastor or whatever it is, and you fall into self-pity. Well, number one, it's presumptuously dangerous, for one thing, to begin to imagine that you're the only faithful Catholic in the midst. It's also presumptuous to imagine that you yourself are a faithful Catholic. Be careful with that, by the way. God, there's a sense of humor there that can sometimes come around to bite you. But no matter where you are, maybe you're like one of a few voices in your parish, in your mind, for fidelity to the truth or whatever. You're not one against 450. Or maybe you look at the culture around us and you see this increasing secularization, and you're like, oh man, it's going to be so hard to be a faithful Catholic, where religious freedom is under attack and under threat and yada, 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 yada. Elijah says, cry me a river. It was me against 450. We'll pick this up in the next hour. Actually, he inspires our question today, which we'll get to on the other side of the segment of the commercial break. This is the Mike Allen Show. We'll be back in just a minute. Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show on this Thursday, June 9th. Question of the day today, inspired by the biblical hero we've been reading about in the first readings for the Mass this week. I said this is a month, really, where there's a lot of first readings in the Mass from that are either about or from Old Testament prophets. And, of course, In a sense, the culmination of the focus on the prophet will be the nativity of St. John the Baptist that we celebrate on June 24th, who comes really as the last and, in many ways, the consummating figure on this whole issue of prophecy. He's the forerunner before the Christ and so forth. So anyway, but we were talking about Elijah and the odds against him, 450 prophets of Baal to just little old him. And yet that didn't keep him from his conviction, his willingness to stand up against the powers that be, even those that could easily take his life, and did it with a great confidence that the God of Israel had his back. So it got me thinking about Old Testament models of courage. Who in your mind is your favorite, or you think is the most powerful Old Testament model of courage? Love to hear from you on this. 573-4BREAD-4 is the number you can call or text. 573-4BREAD-4. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post your thought or your response on Facebook or on Twitter. Deacon Skip responding, and I'd love to get some more responses. He says, Abraham, and this is how he explains it. He embraced monotheism in a culture and clan that was fiercely polytheistic. He followed the instruction of his God to leave everyone and everything to migrate to a land that he didn't know and that he had no chance of finding on his own. He trusted in a God who promised him not only prodigy, but offspring as numerous as the sands on the shore of the sea. When in his dotage, that's a word I don't think I've ever heard before, dotage, D-O-T-A-G-E. He finally had a son with his barren wife, Sarah. He had the trust and the guts to take that coveted son to Mount Moriah to sacrifice him at the command of the Lord. There are many, many things interwoven in his story that I don't have time to mention. But if he didn't have the soaring courage to answer the most unlikely of calls, there wouldn't have been a Hebrew race, and it would have postponed the redemption of the human race indefinitely. But that's just my opinion. Deacon Skip, never one bashful with his opinion, any more than me, of course. Anyway, no, but great point. Abraham, no doubt, a towering figure in salvation history in the Old Testament. The thing that should be encouraging to us, though, about people like Abraham, or maybe even Moses or David, is that they also had moments of incredible weakness and timidity. I mean, think about Abram himself. You've got that account where he goes into Egypt and with Sarah, Sarai at the time, his wife, who evidently was a beautiful woman, and a Pharaoh, it's good to be the king, came and wanted her for himself. And Abram told Sarai to tell people in Egypt that she was his sister. Otherwise, as an obstacle to her being claimed, I guess, for the king's harem, they might decide to do away with Abram. So he had her say that she was his sister. So not exactly models of perfection, but that's, again, that's the grace of God working with human material, even in our fallenness, and doing great things. It's truth about the call to sainthood. Don't ever think you're not saint material. I mean, who else does God have to work with but people just like you and me? Anyway, so maybe you've got a thought on that. 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. You can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Maybe that's really is a profile in courage when you are able to overcome your own innate timidity and weakness, and through sheer trust and by God's mercy, you're able to stand. Moses, very similar, right? Moses, who initially resisted God's call. Who am I that I should lead the people of Israel? I've got a speech problem and so forth. And yet, by God's grace, he was able to overcome. You can go through the list. I tell you, as somebody often not thought of, but somebody I so admired that almost named one of my sons this, the prophet Nathan. I love the prophet Nathan, because Nathan is the one, if you'll recall, who had the temerity to confront King David after his adulterous and murderous behavior. It was Nathan who could have easily done like everyone else. He's the king. He can do what he wants. But really, we see the seeds in Israel's history of the reality that would become manifest in secular governments later on, really, that the king is not above the law, and particularly not above the divine law. And it was Nathan who went to David, told him this little parable about a man who had a little ewe lamb who he loved, just like a child, and how the wealthy king came and seized that little lamb so that he could feed one of his guests instead of taking a lamb from his own flocks. And David flew into a rage and demanded to know the identity of the rich man that he might bring him to justice. And Nathan has that famous line, which, I'm sorry, reads better in the King James English, "Thou art the man." Then you could also think about some of the courageous women in the Old Testament as well. Others, for example, who are overlooked in Exodus chapter 1, Shiphrah and Puah, the two Hebrew midwives who resisted Pharaoh's command to kill all the firstborn male babies among the Hebrews. As it says in Exodus 1, when the Pharaoh called them in to demand why they weren't following his order, they responded, "Oh, the Hebrew women are much more stout than the Egyptian women. When we get to them," these midwives said, "they've already had their baby and moved on." But what I love about the passage is it says the reason that they did not follow Pharaoh's command is not because they were fearless. It says they feared God. So sometimes courage is a matter of directing our fear to the right place. fearing God more than we fear others. As Jesus himself said, do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather fear the one who can destroy both body and soul in hell. We'll get back to this. But if you've got a contribution, we'd love to hear from you. 573-4BREAD-4. Email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Cavaliers bouncing back. I saw bits and pieces of it last night before I went to bed of Cleveland with the big 30-point win over Golden State. Pretty impressive. I flipped on my laptop and saw that the Cavaliers were up something like 20 points at the end of the first quarter. Then I saw the Warriors sort of climbing back into it and thought, well, this could get interesting. Maybe the Warriors have survived this initial onslaught and now they're going to come back and make a game of it, but evidently not. And this makes Golden State, I think, 0 for their last 4 in game 3s in the playoffs. So I'm not sure what that says, but that sets up game 4 again for the Cavs as a must win. You don't want to come back to Oakland down 3-1. But what's, I think, been somewhat impressive about the Cavaliers, even in their first 2-game losses, is been the way they've defended the Splash Brothers, and particularly Steph Curry. But last night, only 29 points between Curry and Thompson. And the Cavaliers, of course, doing without Kevin Love, which if you're Kevin Love, you may have to start thinking, how badly do they need me? LeBron, with his typical brilliance last night, 32 points, 11 rebounds, and 6 assists. But Kyrie Irving, particularly in the first, most of the first half, was just absolutely brilliant, creating space for himself and also distributing the ball well. So we'll see it. Game 4, Friday night. Can the Warriors bounce back? Let's move on to the What Were You Thinking? We've got a few we can squeeze in here. It's never hard, for whatever reason, to find these. Oftentimes I go to FARC.com, which has some excellent stories, or I just look up Reddit's News of the Stupid. Anyway, Brandon, Manitoba. Police in Western Manitoba have arrested a couple after they ran out on a restaurant bill but left their child behind. Note to self. Brandon police said they were called to a restaurant on Tuesday night after husband and wife ran up a tab of $135 and then bolted. They left behind their 10-year-old daughter. Honey, I keep feeling like I forgot something. Police say they caught up to the intoxicated suspects a short distance away. The pair was taken to the Brandon Correctional Center. The child taken into the care of Child and Family Services. Well, that's not funny. But come on. Really? Anyway, so that's our first nominee. Let's see. Second nominee. Oh, yeah. Adidas misspells Colombia in their soccer ads. They spelled it with a U in the middle instead of in an O in the middle. Come on, Adidas. Need to be thinking about something other than what you all day think about, I guess. We'll be back with the winner. This is the Mike Allen Show. Right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show. With a number of daughters in the house, I've been exposed frequently to the music of Taylor Swift. I've always thought of her as a very talented musician, singer-songwriter, a very driven person as well, with enormous success. Never thought of her as a theologian, but then I ran across this article by Dr. Stephen Bullivant called A Theology of Swift, in the Catholic publication America, and Dr. Bullivant, who is a senior lecturer in theology and ethics at St. Mary's University in London, so no academic lightweight, So looking forward to my conversation with him from jolly old England, Dr. Bullivant, with us. Good morning, sir.
Well, it's a genuine pleasure, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Yes, especially glad to catch you before you go away on holiday.
Yeah, we're going tonight. So, no, I'm delighted to do this.
Fantastic. And hopefully your little girls, they're a little young for Taylor Swift, 1 and 4, I guess.
The eldest likes some of it, yeah. She's got some odd tastes in music. She quite likes Meatloaf and, Cyndi Lauper and, she tends to fixate on certain songs that you have to listen to death. Yeah.
All the joys of parenthood. Well, you say in your article, it was the students that you teach that really first attuned you to the music of Taylor Swift.
Yeah, it was. My wife and I used to be the kind of community leaders at a student house, a bit like a Newman Center house called Benedict XVI House at St. Mary's. And it was a particular group of girls who were just constantly listening to Taylor Swift and had it on in the background. And I sort of make jokes, about T-Swizzle or whatever. But then actually, I eventually ended up listening to it. And I remember the moment it happened because I was in the Philippines for a conference and I heard a song in a supermarket there. And it's very, very rare that I hear a song out and, memorize a bit of the lyric to then Google it to find out what the song is. But I did, and it was You Belong With Me by Taylor Swift. So it kind of went from there.
Yeah, I'm like you. I'm kind of a fan. I always feel like I have to maybe turn in my man card, for admitting it.
Well, I liked how you set this up by saying, well, I've got loads of daughters in the house, so, obviously I have to listen to it some of the time.
That's right. Just like you had to listen to it for research, right?
Well, that's it. When you get a call from America asking you to do a commission, on Taylor Swift, and, you've got to spend a lot of time online in fan sites and stuff. It's all part of the job.
I was surprised to see it and be reminded in your article that she released her first song 10 years ago this month.
10 years, yeah. She's done a hell of a lot since. I've not been that much in 10 years.
She's a veteran. Now, you're not making the argument, of course, that, that Taylor Swift is a music theologian along the lines, let's say, of a Bob Dylan, for example.
No, certainly not. I mean, I think, when the idea for the article was pitched to me and one of the editors asked me because they knew, I mean, I'd written for them before, but they also knew I was quite a big Taylor Swift fan kind of separately. There's always the temptation to do something quite trite and superficial to try and, wheedle out an implicit theology of certain singers or books. And someone like Bob Dylan's a classic. I'm a huge Bob Dylan fan too. And, there's a period in the late 70s and early 80s when there's a very explicit evangelical Protestantism going on and in his lyrics and in his interviews and in his kind of sermons from stage. And that really isn't the kind of thing you're doing with Taylor Swift. You can do with certain forms of popular music, obviously strands of the blues. I'm a huge kind of a country fan and bluegrass, so there's all sort of scope. But not Taylor Swift in that respect, no.
But even though, as you say in the piece, she is not explicit, at least maybe on a couple of occasions she's been explicit in things that are divine or related to God.
Yeah, and the exceptions really are remarkable. We might talk about that later, yeah.
But you connect St. Thomas Aquinas, who said nothing is out of bounds for the theologian, and
exactly.
Of course God is the God of all things, and maybe what makes her have such appeal with your students, for example, or just even a broader audience like you and me, is that she writes lyrics that tap into the human experience.
Yeah, I think, and that was it. So the idea was, well, I mean, Taylor Swift is hugely successful, and the fact that you and I are having a kind of a fan conversation about her suggests that she reaches very far beyond what you might think her kind of primary target market is. The fact we're having a conversation, thousands of miles apart, and suggest that too. But I mean, this is a huge cultural phenomenon, and not just in terms of album sales, in terms of a kind of cultural reach. I mean, she's often named one of the most powerful women in the world, and we've seen kind of some of the business things around online music and all sorts of stuff. So she's it's a hugely important kind of cultural figure. And the idea there for me as a theologian and also a sociologist, a lot of my work's in the sociology, thinking about, well, what does the popularity of Taylor Swift tell us about the cultures that we live in and to which the church is wanting to bring the gospel? I mean, these are, you know, America and Western Europe, you know, the kind of the mission territory of the new evangelization. What kind of nerves is Taylor Swift touching, and what can that tell the church?
Mm.
You know, especially if there's a lot of recent data in the States about kind of the rise of the nuns, particularly among the young. Well, this is kind of Swift's core audience. So what's she connecting with there that the church isn't?
We're talking with Dr. Stephen Bullivant, who is senior lecturer in theology and ethics at St. Mary's University in London. There's an autobiographical quality in her music. It's you know, a young woman who is coming of age. And as you said, that's part of the appeal among some of your students, for example. You mentioned the song 15. I give talks to young people sometimes on St. John Paul II's Theology of the Body. And one remark I make is, even though I don't think that Taylor Swift has read the Theology of the Body, the very idea in this song, when someone tells you they love you, you're going to believe them.
Yeah.
And this understanding of her inner song, the friend Abigail, who gave everything she had to a boy who changed his mind, that's very much a Catholic understanding of sexuality and the gift of the body.
It really is. And I think that, I mean, this is one of the, you always come across this phrase relatable with Taylor Swift. And I think if she couldn't write songs, then, you know, she wouldn't be popular. But I mean, you've got a songwriter of genuine genius, I mean, no doubt about that, who is writing about what it's like being a 15, 16, 17, 18, 19-year-old, you know, young person in America. While she's doing it, I mean, this isn't a kind of, you know, someone looking back, or kind of, you know, 50-year-old male songwriters in Tin Pan Alley thinking kind of, what do the young people want to hear? I mean, the fact, you know, she's in her mid-20s, and, you know, the reason we're talking about her now is because of the 10th anniversary of the single Tim McGraw from the first album. Those songs, I mean, 15 is a classic example. You know, I think she wrote the song 15, you know, when she was probably about 16 or 17. I mean, and that's the case of all these very intensely, you know, autobiographical stuff that she's writing. It's this kind of ethnography of navigating relationships and possibilities and heartbreak and excitements of young people today. And, you know, again, you know, I'm not a young person today. I'm certainly, you know, I'm into my 30s now, and, you know, on a different continent. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff in some of the Taylor Swift high school songs that I can remember very vividly.
Mm-hmm.
The song Mean, you know, could have been written about against me at high school, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. That's a song. I've actually written about that song as an analogy of sorts of venial sin. How the choices we make, and, you know, all you're ever going to be is mean. So, for example, you know, you continue to be mean, it's going to shape your character to the point that this defines who you are.
Yeah, that's like kind of Aristotelian. If you start off doing mean stuff, then that's going to create a mean person. Yeah,
exactly. Now, you do mention there are a couple of instances where where faith references are more explicit.
Yeah, there are, and I mean, you can kind of comb them to find, you know, those songs called things of State of Grace and Holy Ground. But I mean, it's a very weak metaphor in those songs. But there's two songs that really leap out. There's a kind of a forgotten Christmas EP that I think kind of was sold in Target stores, you know. And there's a song on that she wrote, and she pretty much writes. There's a couple of covers on that Christmas album, and again, you know, Bob Dylan had a great Christmas album as well. There's other overlaps here. But there's a song that she wrote, not even co-written, called, I think, Christmas Must Be Something More, or Christmas Should Be Something More. And yeah, some of the lyrics on that about the baby boy who saved the world, or about Jesus Christ who saved the world, is really kind of jarringly charismatic, not just because Taylor Swift tends to be very reticent about her own religious, political opinions, that kind of stuff. You know, when she's very sharing about kind of everything else. But even in the kind of the genre of the Christmas song, it's very rare in modern Christmas pop songs to be very explicit about Jesus and salvation. So, I mean, that's a song that really stands. It's not a great, I don't think it's a great song. I mean, you know, it hardly ranks up at, you know, the upper echelons of Taylor Swift's music, which, you know, is no criticism of the song. That's just a comment on how high those upper echelons go. But the lyrical contents and the kind of lack of punch-pulling in the lyrics is clear. The other one that struck me listening to it was... I think the title's Innocent. It's a song that, again, if you go into the backstory, it's meant to be a response to Kanye West dissing her at the...
Hey, Dr. Bullivant?
...or the MTV Music Awards.
Dr. Bullivant, we're about out of time. Would you...
Oh, no. Okay, great.
Thank you so much for giving us a lot to think about. I hope you have a great holiday with those little girls and enjoy
Thanks
yourself.
Thank you very much.
Keep
you
up the great.
You listen to on the long journey there.
All right, take care. We'll be back in just a minute. Bye. This is the Mike Allen Show. Welcome back into the Mike Allen Show. Question of the day. Who is your favorite Old Testament model of courage? Really, no shortage of supply there. 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to call or text. Or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Interesting conversation with Dr. Stephen Bullivant there. You know, here's this respected academe, and he's writing an article about the theology of T-Swizzle, of Taylor Swift. Miss here, okay? We're not arguing for some sort of intellectual profundity in all of Taylor Swift's music. But I do think he makes a good point that when something is as wildly popular as the music of Taylor Swift and such an icon of the culture, it does bear saying, you know, it's not just the catchiness of her tunes. What is it that she's tapping into? Because if we're about the work of the new evangelization, if we're about the good news of Jesus. What is the good news? You know, what is it that we have to share? That was a question I asked two nights ago when we had a focus group meeting at a local parish with some Catholics from various areas. And we talked about trying to articulate, because if we're going to share the good news, we have to articulate what the good news is. And the good news, by its very nature, speaks to something that is obviously hungered for in the human condition. And so when you look at a popular artist who appeals to people and who connects with people, particularly the young who, as Dr. Bullivant pointed out, lead the way in this rise of the new nuns, not the ladies wearing habits, but the N-O-N-E-S, then maybe it bears asking ourselves, what is it that she's tapping into? And, one thing he mentioned in the article, which I didn't realize, is that there have been whispers that Taylor Swift is a cradle Catholic. And I don't know if she's practicing her faith. I certainly pray that she is. But that she's kept that pretty much under wraps, unlike so many other things in her life, you know, airing out her own broken romances and all the rest. But, you know, it's a good article. I'll post a link to it on the show's Facebook page. There's already a link to it on the show's blog. And maybe you want to chime in with your thoughts about it as well. Yeah, that song Mean, like I said, I wrote an article about that because it struck me. We oftentimes minimize venial sins. And yet, you know, those sins that are more of defects or weaknesses of character than they are brazen rebellions. But as the song says, someday I'll be singing in a big old city or living in a big old city, and all you're ever going to be is mean. Very akin to what C.S. Lewis talked about. Every choice we make shapes our character in one direction or another. And if we choose, for example, to be mean, as in the context of this song, over time it will define us, which connects very closely with my theory that all things being equal, unless there's some issue of dementia, when you get to be an old person, which is increasingly within my vision, when you get to be an old person, you tend to become an exaggerated version of who you were throughout your entire life. That's pretty sobering. So anyway, but maybe you've got a comment on that, or maybe you think it's a bunch of hogwash, to put it kindly, to talk about the theology of T. Swift. I want to get back. I'd forgotten about my conversation with Dr. Bullivant, and so wasn't able to give you the winner of the What Were You Thinking Award. Besides the couple who ran out on their restaurant bill and, of course, left their 10-year-old child behind, or Adidas, who misspelled Columbia in a major ad campaign. All day I dream about geography. Adidag, maybe that's what Adidas needs to shift to. But the winner we're going to actually give to Facebook. This pointed out by Terry Mattingly on the blog getreligion.org. He said, just what we need, another controversy involving Facebook and its trending news feature, which is apparently important for legions of social media content consumers. He said, what I mean is this, does anyone out there in cyberspace have evidence, perhaps a screenshot or a URL in a Wayback storage program to back up those banging head-on-desk items about an alleged Facebook trending story that ran with this headline? Basically asking, is there any proof that Facebook actually wrote this headline in their trending news stories? And here was the headline. Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Renovations begin on site where Christians believe Jesus is buried. And then someone came through with a screenshot of that exactly news trending item on Facebook that said that exact thing. Renovations begin on site where Christians believe Jesus is buried. Not was buried, is buried. Yeah, that's all those people flocking to see Jesus' grave, I guess. Oh, somebody. And people wonder why the media gets accused of not getting religion, which is what this website, getreligion.org, is centered around, this idea. Now, on the plus side, I guess you would say, this is what sets Christianity apart, is that it is a historical faith. In other words, if you want to disprove Christianity, or if they had wanted to disprove the good news about the risen Christ from the very beginning, all they had to do was produce a body. And those who say if they produced a body, or if Jesus in fact was not risen, or only if his memory was alive, then they'd still be a Christian. Well, St. Paul does not agree with you. He says if Christ is not risen, we are to be pitied above all men. So maybe we should give thanks to Facebook for pointing out the reminder that our faith, our hope, is all rooted in the belief in a historical event that Christ isn't buried there, that he was buried there. 573-4BREAD-4, we're always looking for your nominees, maybe even from your own life. 573-4BREAD-4, you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. All attention now, turning to the two primary candidates, major party candidates for president of the United States, Hillary Clinton and Donald J. Trump, both of whom seem to be, at this point, have locked in their nominations, and the question beginning to be raised about who their running mate is going to be. I did come across an interesting article about the Donald. And I will say this, even though I look at the choice between two major party candidates this fall with great frustration, because as I've shared, I think, with you before, I can't in good conscience vote for either. That doesn't mean it won't be an interesting race. One piece I saw in New York Magazine, it's from Frank Rich, so you can take it with a grain of salt, but it says, what the Donald shares with the Ronald. The Trump candidacy looks a lot more like Reagan's than anyone might care to notice. Now, when I saw that, my mind immediately jumped to, I remember when I was a kid having a penny attached to a little piece of paper that had a listing of all the things that Lincoln and Kennedy had in common. I think it was a Lincoln penny that had been put out commemorative that had a little silhouette of Kennedy right oftentimes to the right of Lincoln's bust. They were kind of facing each other. And it went through, and you've probably seen these before, all these things that they had in common. Things like Lincoln's secretary Kennedy warned him not to go to the theater. Kennedy's secretary Lincoln warned him not to go to Dallas, and number of letters in their name and a bunch of stuff like that all in there, right? Comparisons between people, not shocking, but this was an interesting one. What the Donald shares with the Ronald. And it goes on to say that you can really, in many ways, look at Trump's candidacy as having some similarities to the rise of Ronald Reagan. Let's see really quick. I think we may have a phone call. Oh, Paul calling in. Paul, hello.
Hey, Mike, how you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. We got a couple minutes.
Hey, I know. Okay, so my hero, always infatuated with this person, would be Ruth.
Hmm. Oh, yeah.
Ancestor of David and, of course, Jesus.
Yes.
And she did a lot, did so much for her mother-in-law, and it always fascinated me. I just always liked the story about her.
Yeah, there's a beautiful, her beautiful statement of devotion there in Ruth chapter 1, where you die, I will die, and where you're buried, I'll be buried. Your God will be my God. It's nothing but death will separate me from you. It's a beautiful testament.
And just the tie back that she's related to Jesus is amazing to me. So,
especially when you consider the fact that she was not Jewish.
Oh, that's right. I forget about that. That's correct. She was a Moabite, right?
That's correct. Yeah, she was a Moabite, which, one of those, and she's one of the names mentioned in Jesus' genealogy. One of the, I think, only four women who are mentioned in his genealogy, she's one of them.
Yeah, so I always liked the story about her, and I used to work with a woman named Ruth, and I used to tell her, I like your name so much, because it's kind of an old-fashioned name, but I just love that name, too.
And it's the great thing about that book is it's only four chapters. You can sit down and read it in one reading, and it's one of the great short stories in Scripture. Paul, I really appreciate the call. Thanks.
Yep. Have a good day.
You too. Absolutely. I'll love to hear from you. Thanks for calling, Paul. 573-4-BREAD-4. Who is your favorite Old Testament model of courage? Ruth, certainly. A courage of its own sort, loyalty, fidelity, and faith. We'll be back on the other side of the break. This is the Mike Allen Show.